Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubenstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Hi everyone, how's it going? Hope your week is getting off to a great start. May half term is coming up here in England at the end of the month, so I imagine a lot of you will be heading off on some kind of travels, so let me know how it goes. Let me know your favourite spots that you discover along the way, if you chose to go anywhere that you heard about here on the pod. I'm just back actually from a week in Menorca, one of the Balearic Islands off the coast of Spain. I actually talk with Sam, my guest today, about Menorca. I was just about to head off there when we spoke. I'd never been before. I'd been to Mallorca and Ibiza, and I'd heard that it was not only great for families, but that it had just a really appealing, low-key, relaxed vibe about it, and that its beaches were some of the best in Europe. And it definitely delivered on all those fronts. We loved it. We stayed at a hotel which only just opened last summer, so you might not have heard of it yet. It's called Villa LeBlanc, a Gran Melia hotel. And I'm just so excited to tell you all about it because it is one of the best new openings in Europe, as far as I'm concerned, from the last few years. And this isn't sponsored content, by the way. I was out there to review it for my work, and we paid to extend our time there because we loved it so much. And I just wanted to tell you about it because I love discovering new hotels, as you probably know by now. So this hotel is like the epitome of, I was trying to think about the best way to describe it, and I'd say it's like beachfront chic. The decor, the interiors reminded me of California, so classy, like really airy and light and summery. Nearly all the rooms and suites look out over the Mediterranean through big floor-to-ceiling windows framed by palm trees, and you can see Mallorca in the distance. You really feel like you're enveloped in the beach and the sea. And it's one of those rare hotel gems I've realised now with a baby that caters perfectly to both families and solo travellers or couples. There are two incredibly photogenic pools. And one is adults only. That's on the roof of the hotel, and it has these amazing views over the beach. And then the other is family friendly, though I always want to qualify, not overtly family friendly, very classy, lined with giant cabana beds with beautiful canopies. You can literally hear the waves lapping in the distance. Beautiful. There's a little beach just outside the gate, perfect for little ones. It's so shallow and calm. People were wading out for miles. And people come from all over the island to watch the sunset here. There are three restaurants, two of which face outwards towards the sunset, meaning that every dinner that we had there was accompanied by this incredible display of nature at its best. The best sunsets I've ever seen, truly. Boats would come and moor up there to watch the sunset. It's such a special spot. And if, like me, you're traveling with a little one, they had all the gear that you could need, all the nicest quality stuff too, so you'd be well looked after. A really great new hotel to add to your hotel bucket list. If you decide to go, let me know. I'll give you all my tips. Okay, on to today's guest. I have a guest today that I think will reignite your sense of adventure and reaffirm your love of nature. You know, I've had over 100 guests now, and Sam Branson is up there in terms of his passion and love for travel, the power of it, the importance of it, its symbiosis with nature and our planet. It's a powerful listen. Sam is a very busy man indeed. He's one of those people where the list of things that they do in their bio goes on for so long that you question what you've done with your own life. Adventurer, filmmaker, singer-songwriter, charity founder, business leader, social entrepreneur, and that's just the beginning of it. As an adventurer, his feats match some of the greatest names in the field. He spent 3 months crossing the Arctic on a dog sled. He's climbed epic peaks. He's kayaked treacherous stretches of water. He's set numerous world records, including, curiously, running the London Marathon attached to 33 other people. None of it, of course, was done without a wider cause. And charity is a huge focus for Sam, and he has founded several charities himself, raising several million pounds in the process. He's also hugely passionate about our planet, and many of the challenges he's undertaken have been to raise awareness and create action around climate change. He speaks with such warmth about nature. And this has transcended into his new venture, music. He's just released his debut album under his musical name, Waves Rush In. The album's called Under the Static, which is a love letter to Mother Nature and the perfect soundtrack to summer. Very chilled, very mellow. I really enjoyed listening to it. Alongside all of this, which is making me exhausted just thinking about it, he's found time to co-found and run a documentary company alongside Hillary and Chelsea Clinton. Now, obviously, a lot of this opportunity has come from Sam being born into the Branson family, being the son of Sir Richard Branson. And we discuss this privileged upbringing in the episode and how he's strived for his own self-identity since. All of this makes it a really fascinating listen, I think, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's get started. Sam Branson, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It's great to see you today. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And very grateful to be here and speak to you today.
Awesome. Well, you were just recently back from another stint in the Arctic, I saw.
Yeah. We had a pretty amazing time in Lapland in the Arctic Circle. And it was pretty magical.
It looked absolutely beautiful. What were you doing there?
We were doing an event which I co-founded with my cousin called Strive Challenge. And it was initially set up to try and give people the experiential learning that I had on my first big Arctic expedition while raising funds for Big Change, which is an organization that I co-founded to help young people thrive in life, not just exams. Mm-hmm. And we do multi-discipline challenges all over the world. And so far we've traveled, I think, about 6,000 kilometers, raised 7.5 million quid and had hundreds of people join us on these very challenging but very rewarding experiences. And the latest one was in Lapland and doing all sorts of fun things in the Arctic.
Fun, but also quite physically demanding.
I find physically demanding is fun.
Yeah, we're going to come on to that later, actually, because it's like kind of baffling the amount of kind of physical challenges you put yourself through. But it's all good fun, is it?
Yeah, I mean, not always. but there's never been an experience where I haven't challenged myself physically and mentally and not come out the back end of it feeling more inspired and more self-aware and have more courage. People always ask me, you know, what are you doing to train for Strive? And I'm like, I'm not. I'm using Strive to train for life. And that's my sort of perspective.
I really like that. I also really like what you said about kind of thriving in life, not just like in exams or in the classroom. Mm. Because we have so much to learn from travel.
Mm. So much. I mean, if I look back on my life, the things that I've learned the most, it's experiencing new places, new cultures. And it enables you to have an objective perspective on your life, in your day-to-day life, and don't take anything for granted. And also, you don't judge anyone because, you know, everyone lives such different dynamic lives. And at the end of the day, as different lives we lead, my biggest insight is we're all pretty similar and we're all experiencing the same emotions. And underneath whatever the specific event is that we're experiencing, we're still all feeling fear and love and joy and all the things that come with being a human. So it's this wonderful mix between traveling and seeing the diversity in which human beings live and how we are, but equally all our similarities at the same time.
Mm, there's a universality that is universality a word? A
universality. We'll give it to you.
That comes with travel, and like you say, a connectedness. And I imagine, I don't know, from your own experience, being born into a famous family with famous parents, where people are always going to have, I suppose, a preconceived idea of who you might be or come into having preconceptions about you. Has travel really helped you kind of deal with what that must have been like growing up, I suppose?
Yeah, I think when I was younger, it impacted me more. And I think I would go into a room and have a little bit of, you know, as we all are when we're young, a little bit self-aware, self-conscious, and that added a bit of a pressure to that situation. You know, my when I was younger, my best thing was like, oh my God, you're actually really lovely and really normal. And I used to kind of strive for that. And actually you realize, hold on, why should I not be normal just because I've been born into this situation? Because I've traveled and I've experienced people who live in mud huts, who have nothing in a material sense, but have everything in terms of things that bring a quality of life, a sense of community and family and love and purpose. And I've also met people who have so many material things who are unhappy, and it makes you realize that actually it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, you're never immune to struggle, and you're always capable of joy.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, I just stopped caring because, you know, I became more and more, you know, self-loving and self-aware, and I understand who I am. And now I've sort of lived, you know, coming up for 40 years, feel like I've got insights of lessons I've learned along the way to share with people.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear some more of those coming up on today's episode. We're going to be going on a journey through the 7 chapters of your travel diary, Sam. I'm going to go back to the very beginning. Chapter 1 is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
So I was very lucky enough to have parents who spent a lot of time in the Caribbean, and we had a second home out there in the British Virgin Islands called Necker, and I think I went there when I was 3 months old. I can't remember that specifically, but I very much remember, you know, our life was very day-to-day in England, school, home, school, home, school, home. And then in holiday times, we were blessed enough to go to that environment and just be immersed in nature and with the Caribbean culture. And that was very informative, I think, to the person that I am today, and enabled me to come back to school and my day-to-day life with a slightly different, broader perspective. Mm-hmm. And then I think also going to Menorca with my cousins, I got lots of cousins, and we used to just build forts, and we would go there quite regularly and mess around in Port Mahon and jump off cliffs and swim and do all the catch fish and all that stuff too.
Well, I don't want to make this about myself, but I'm going to Menorca for the first time on Monday. Do you have any tips for where to go? I'm going for my second trip abroad with my baby. I would love any recommendations because I hear it's great for families.
It's really, really great for families and young kids. And what's it? Binny Beck is worth visiting. There's Cipriani's restaurant, which is lovely. But I think anywhere around the port of Mahon is really beautiful, and there's lots of fun things to do. These days I'm a go to bed early, get up early guy. But you know, in Spain it's a completely different story. You go to dinner at 9 and no bars open till about 1 in the morning. So you're going to have to slot into that if you feel like that sort of thing.
Get the snooze shade on and the white noise cranked up. Yeah. And get out.
Yeah, exactly. But it can get quite hot in the day, so you can see why people nap it in midday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, going back to Necker then, I mean, obviously it's probably one of the most famous kind of islands in the world, I would say. But I mean, Necker is obviously inaccessible for 99.99% of the population to get to. But the broader BVIs isn't necessarily, you know, where would you recommend for somebody who'd like to get a taste of, you know, the Necker life, but maybe, you know, wants to get a taste of that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the BVI is my second home. It's not Necker that's necessarily my second home. I grew up all around those islands and
hopping between the different islands.
Yeah, and just plugged into the community. Like I got friends, local friends out there that I've known since I was born, it's just a wonderful, wonderful culture. So you know, there's Virgin Gorda, then there's Tortola, which is the main island. There's Joost van Dijk. You know, there's lots of different places people can visit. And if anyone, you know, can, taking a boat is one of the biggest charter boat places in the world. There's thousands and thousands of people every year come in. If you can't sail, you can get it with a captain, or if you can do that, or there's many, many, many different places you can stay. And I think one of the gems out there is Anegada. It's a low-lying island right on the very edge of the BVI. Completely rugged and rustic. You can surf there. Some of the best kiting in the world. And I've been really rustic, but it's magical. And that's definitely should be on a hit list for people traveling to the areas. And if you want a really, really fun party, you've got to go to the Willy Tea. It's a floating bar restaurant that's well worth a visit.
Is that from Anagada?
No, it's off actually Norman Island, which is where Treasure Island was written about.
Wow.
And it's a floating two-decked ship, kind of piratey ship that has a lot of fun times on it. I've had a lot of birthdays there over the years.
That sounds so fun. So the islands are all pretty near to each other, so you could like experience multiple little islands in one trip?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the only thing is you need a boat to get around, and there's taxi boats that go around and things like that. Mm-hmm. You'd either probably go to one of the main islands, so Virgin Gorda or Tortola, and then you can get around there. And if anyone is in the area, look up Gumption Glass Bottom Boat. He's a mate of mine that I've known since I was a kid, and he's set up a little glass bottom boat company, and he's a great guy. And actually we do through Gumption tours of Necker Island, all the animals, so people can come onto Necker and look at all the wildlife, which my dad is nicknamed Dr. Doolittle out there because he's obsessed with animals and has created a bit of a haven for endangered species on Necker as well.
So tell me about some of the animals on Necker, because it is amazing.
We've got all sorts. We've got lemurs, which are just, we've got all sort of ringtail lemurs, black and white lemurs, brown lemurs, red ruffs. We've got flamingos, scarlet ibis. We've got giant Galapagos tortoises, which actually for the first time in history have had babies outside of the Galapagos on Necker. So they're famously very, very hard for them to feel comfortable enough to have babies. And so we've got lots of baby.
God, that must have been so emotional for Dr. Doolittle.
he wouldn't even know. He gets pretty emotional when it comes to the animals, for sure. It's just, what a joy to have a place out there where we can help to, you know, nurture struggling species.
Sounds like a magical thing to witness. And obviously during your childhood, thinking about childhood and travel, your dad was going around the world completing these like epic challenges and setting crazy records and doing things that were pretty unusual for a dad. So which sticks out in your mind when you were at home and like watching him?
He used to go on obviously these big world record breaking adventures, and I think when I the transatlantic speed records, I was quite young, so I can't really remember. And equally with the Atlantic world record balloon and Pacific, I was pretty young. I think the time I remember the most is when I was in sort of very early teens, 10 to early teens, and that was when he was attempting around the world to be the first around the world in a balloon.
And so
I remember going, and you know, all the fanfare around it and knowing this big thing was happening, and amongst all the noise there was just me as a little boy thinking, oh, I really hope my daddy comes home. And so it was challenging, and you know, it's not till I've become a grown-up and had a kind of objective perspective to kind of process some of that, but equally incredibly exciting and incredibly inspiring. And his tenacity and drive and passion to adventure and has definitely informed me. And as I've become amongst other things in my life, an adventurer myself, I can see why I may not dangle myself from a floating balloon thousands of feet in the air personally, but I do know what one gains and experiences from stepping out of your comfort zone.
That's what I was going to ask, really, is, you know, how seeing something like that, seeing like the balloon, for example, like how, whether the fear overwhelmed the excitement or vice versa in terms of how it influenced your sense of adventure moving forward into your life now.
I don't know. I think at the time I was just more scared than anything, and then very relieved when my dad came home alive and well. I think it's not so much that informed me, but more just the way I was brought up and the type of person my dad is, and and my cousins and all of us, you know, we would go for lunch and my dad would be like, right, we're walking through the woods, and we would get lost for 3 hours and turn up at lunch late and have had a massive adventure to get there. And because we were lucky enough to travel, we would go to, you know, amazing environments, of which adventures, you know, different sports and extreme sports. And it was just a part. It's, I think adventure is adventure, but there's being adventurous is more apt. And it's just being born into a family which likes to experience new things. And luckily I have a working class Glaswegian mother who's so down to earth, doesn't suffer any falls and take any crap, and could not really be more salt of the earth. So it was a really lovely balance. I think she kept our feet on the ground in and amongst all the excitement.
Well, chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with, Sam. Where comes to mind for that?
So as a child, it was the BVI. But I think to give the answer a proper question, as an adult in my own sort of choices of where to go, I'll never forget when I went traveling when I was 18 and I went to Australia, and it was the first trip I ever took with a mate, with no parents, totally on our own, doing our own thing, and how I just absolutely fell in love with Australia. I fell in love with Australian people. They're very much my approach to life, which is greet everyone like they're your best mate until they do something to prove you otherwise. And they have this very open-hearted, sport, fitness-orientated lifestyle. And I just had an absolute blast there learning to surf. And I just, every time I go back to Australia, I just am so excited because in part the Australian people, but also the place. And it's modern, but it's also still rugged and wild, and it's got a bit of cowboy vibe to it too.
What parts of Australia did you spend a lot of time in, and which in particular would you always want to go back to?
So I spent most of my time on the East Coast, like Brisbane, Surfers Paradise, Sydney, a bit of time in Melbourne. But the place that really captured my heart was Byron Bay. And I'm a bit of a hippie. Byron is just wicked. I love it. The music, the food, the energy, the surf, the whole culture there is just, yeah. If you said I couldn't live in the BVI and I couldn't live in my home in Oxford, that's where I'd probably go. Well, they're more outdoors focused, and I think the weather helps. But I think, you know, and therefore when you're in an outdoor focus, you're in a fit focus. When you're in a fit focus, you eat healthy, the food, and people are calmer, because really the number one thing that any of us can do if we want to, the magic pill to live longer, be calmer, think less, feel more, be more positive, is exercise. And I think the Australian population, partly due to their climate, live a very outdoorsy, fit, active lifestyle, and that breeds into their personality.
Yeah, we're speaking on a rather gloomy day here in England, aren't we?
Yeah.
Harder to get out and about, isn't it?
It's harder, but I can't remember who said the quote, but there's no such thing as bad weather, there's just bad equipment.
Yeah. Exactly.
Always reminds me to kick myself up the arse in the winter.
I think most Scandinavians' catchphrase that one.
Yes. Yeah. But they also take their babies out in minus 30 and just leave them out in the pram outside because it's good for them. So that's quite extreme. I don't know if I would feel comfortable doing that with my newborn, but, you know, they all seem to survive.
Yeah. So you've obviously, we've touched on the feats of endurance that you have undertaken to, you know, raise money for charity, and you've sailed across the Atlantic, you've gone through the Arctic wilderness, you've been in the peaks of the Himalayas, obviously hugely physically arduous, although as you've said, enjoyable. I wondered, in terms of the first loves, did you fall in love with some of these environments that you were doing something, you know, very challenging in, but, you know, the place, the destination, the landscape?
I mean, it's my whole driving motive, really. I remember actually when I was a kid with my dad, and he was looking over the balcony in the BVI, and he just said, "What a beautiful view." And I remember as a kid, like, I'd grown up being there, and I remember thinking, oh, it was a change of perspective. I was always like, that's just what I'm looking at. And I was like, I want to look at the world that way. And I think that sowed a seed and set me on a path to kind of exploring the beauty of the world, and 100% all my challenges, the main driving motive why I'm excited to go on a Strive is because it's new environments to be in, and traveling, you get to see the diversity of this world. I mean, it is magical. You know, people say we need to change the world. We don't. We need to change our behavior on this world. This world has evolved through millions of years to be in a relatively harmonious, stable condition. But you can go to like mountain ranges, and you can see jungles and deserts and frozen plains and oceans, and there is just, it's just so dynamic. And so when I go to these places, I fall madly in love with them. And as a, you know, filmmaker and a songwriter, my biggest muse is nature. And so these trips also inform my writing and things like that.
So like, is there a song, for example, in your forthcoming musical debut? Would you say it's a debut?
It's a debut album.
That was particularly inspired by a certain destination.
I mean, all sorts of. If you listen to my music, it's most of them are love songs to Mother Nature. There's a song that I've released, actually the second single on my debut album today. It's called "Watch You Glow," and that's about the sun, and it's paying tribute to the burning ball of life-giving energy that's in our solar system, and it's a tribute to that, and how no matter where I am in the world, I always think it's fascinating when you travel, it's the same sun, it's the same moon, or if one of your loved ones happens to be on the other side of the planet and you miss them, you look up, and if it's nighttime for both of you, can be like, we're both looking at the same moon, and there's a beautiful connectedness there as well.
So I'd love to chat to you a little bit about the Arctic expedition that you, the first Arctic expedition that you did, the really long one, because to embark on something of that length, of that magnitude. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of, you know, these epic physical feats, and we're moving on to a place where you also learnt the most about yourself. I imagine that this 3-month, 1400 mile dog sled expedition that you did, this kind of the magnitude of it. I just wanted to ask you, really, like, how do you prepare for something like that, and get wrap your head around the length of time that you're going to be away, and, you know, what it's going to involve both physically and mentally?
You don't. And I think the key that I learned on that trip was just say yes and then do what you need to do to make it work. There's so many reasons to say no to these things. And I even very, very closely nearly called up Will Steger, who ran the expedition, and said, look, I'm not going to come. 3 months away from everyone I loved, all my creature comforts. I was 23, you know, it's an age of socializing with friends. And do I really want to go on this absolutely brutal challenge? And fear was getting in the way. And I remember just thinking, no, I'm going to do this. And I said yes. And then you just make it happen. And I'm a big believer in the lessons learned in the laboratory of life, and experiential learning is where you gain wisdom. You know, you can the amount of people that read amazing books, but they don't actualize their learning. So it's just intellectual. When you experience learnings, that's when you get wisdom and you gain wisdom. And so, yeah, just going out there and learning on the fly. I remember when I got out there, I went out on a training ride, wasn't wearing enough clothes. There is no space for positivity when you are cold, really cold. And I remember having a little freak out moment. I was like, and the tents were tiny. I was like, how am I going to do this? 3 months, you know,
such a long time.
And I remember looking in the mirror and going, right, you have to look at every single moment as an opportunity to learn and grow. And it was a perspective shift. And that's actually what you gain the most. And also times where I felt like my tank was empty. It was actually half full. I just had to learn how to tap into it. And every time we stopped for a 5-minute break, I would fall asleep. I was that knackered. You couldn't have any of your skin exposed. You know, you literally covered your entire face. Throw a glass of water in the air and it freezes before it hits the ground. You know, it was pretty brutal. But, you know, pan forward a month into the challenge, and I had my routine set, and you know exactly what clothes to wear, and you know the main thing out there is sweat management. If you sweat, you're screwed, because you lose body heat 240 times faster, and all your clothes freeze because there's no way to reheat them, so, or dry them. So it's all learning the routines, and dogs would sleep in a square around us to protect us from polar bears, and you'd have to dig down the snow and put ice screws in and put them in, and all of that was completely new to me. But taking the perspective of using every experience as an opportunity to learn and grow, it enables you to be positive and to look at it as a positive challenge. And then you're 10 times more likely to achieve what you need to achieve. And before, by the end, I was a seasoned explorer and felt like even though I looked like a Yeti, because my beard was bleached white, I looked like Santa Claus. But I felt like I went on into that trip as a young boy, and I came out a man with such a sense of self-pride.
I can imagine. It was, just to give a bit more context, it was a sledding with dogs the whole way, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think we ended up doing 1,200 miles on dog sleds, and there was six of us. Will Steger ran it, and there was five young polar explorers of me, who was the rookie. The other guys are a bit more experienced, but no, it was a magical experience. And I think the main learning I got from that is, when you're that detached from modern civilization for that long, it enables you to have an objective perspective on life. You know, you're fully immersed in nature. You see a mountain in the distance and you think you're going to reach it that afternoon. You don't get there for 4 days. You know, your sense of time shifts. Like, it's such a relatively bland environment, but the more you tune into it, the slight slither of pink in the sky that's different the next day becomes the biggest change. And you attune, you know, which I think is what people used to have a long time ago, this attunement and sensitivity and relationship with their environment, that I think is one of the saddest things in the modern day and age, is actually our detachment from nature, and seeing nature as something separate. And if you look at indigenous tribes, sometimes they don't even have a word for nature. They just have the environment of which we are a part of. And so to gain...
There's no detachment in that way.
No, we are nature.
Yeah, you know, we are nature.
You know, so chopping down a tree is hurting you. And it's like, or in some cultures, like, you know, in Bali and stuff, they take what they need, but then they do this tribute and they say, thank you, I'm so sorry for hurting you, but thank you, we needed this. And it's this symbiotic relationship. And, you know, I just one thing I'm really passionate for my children is for them to have a relationship with nature and a love of nature. And I think that the healing power of that is what the world needs now more than ever.
I mean, what major changes do you hope to see in the way that we travel in the next 10 years? I know that expedition was raising awareness about climate change. You know, what are your hopes with something that's obviously just so hugely important to you?
I hope we can travel in a more environmentally friendly way, because I think traveling is unbelievably important. And I think what it does for people's perspective and what it does for people's sense of self-understanding and our ability to be in relationship with people around the world, regardless of where you live. So I would love to see, evolutions in traveling more sustainably. Like, you know, hopefully we can have breakthroughs with cleaner jet fuels. Hopefully we can, get more electric cars, and which is all, it's all starting to happen. And I think that means that people will be able to travel more without having a negative impact. But I also think I would love to also see cities built with nature in mind, cities built with children in mind. You know, it just seems... cities are not child friendly and they're not green, but it doesn't take too much to put planning into making cities as green as they can be. You know, they did a study on the council estate, and the side of the building that looked onto buildings had a higher violence rate to the opposite side of the building that looked onto trees. So just that connection to nature has such a benefit to our well-being as human beings. And I just, I hope more people can travel and it becomes more affordable as well.
Well, I mean, so much food for thought. Chapter 3 is the place where you learn the most about yourself. I feel like we've gone quite deep. Where are we heading to next?
Well, obviously the Arctic is big, and I think I always learn about myself. I think that's part of the joy in life. Our brains never stop, never tire of learning. But I think for me, this is Bali. So maybe how long ago? 5 years ago, my wife and I decided to do something quite mega when our children were very, very young and go and live in Bali for 3 years. And we just thought, before our kids are in school, let's go off on an adventure. Let's just do something very different. Well, before that, you know, we're pinned to one place for their academic careers and or journeys. And so we went and ended up living in the middle of the jungle, half an hour north of Ubud. And that was just such an incredible experience for us, establishing what our family was like, you know, and with total independence and a completely new culture. I did my meditation teacher training, my yoga teacher training, started to change my focus slightly to pursue my passion for songwriting and music, and starting quite late in the game. And also just being immersed in such a different culture, and the Balinese people are just some of the most special people I've ever come across. Their sense of community, their sense of faith, their open-mindedness, their openness to different faiths as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of Hindu, Buddhist, but there's Muslims there and Christians there, and they all coexist harmoniously. They take such pride in what they do. They have such a sense of duty and love and care and sense of humor. And the reason why I say it is because, A, I learned about myself by taking my explorative nature inside, but also because of what I learned from the Balinese people.
For my listeners who haven't been to Bali, who may now be inspired to go there with their young families for a holiday or for longer, you know, where would you recommend that they visit? Not necessarily live, but, you know, what are some of the places that mean a lot to you that you visited while you were in Bali?
For me, there's lots of amazing parts of Bali. I didn't visit the north of the island much. It's meant to be really beautiful. But Uluwatu in the south along the coast is absolutely beautiful, especially for surfing. If anyone's a surfer, that's a really great place to go. Canggu is amazing, but it's getting quite busy now. It's good fun. Seminyak's quite built up. Kuta, I wouldn't bother visiting. It's been pretty spoiled, sadly, over the years with bad management. But the one place I would say is an absolute must is Ubud. Of all the places in Bali, it's unique. I've never been anywhere in the world like it. It's like a city that grows out of the jungle. Wow. And it's just amazing, amazing food and amazing music and so health and well-being orientated, yoga and meditation and lots of fun things to do, like whitewater rafting and jungle buggying and it's a unique part of the world, Ubud, and so that I would say should be top of the list. And if people decided they wanted to live there, the Green School is probably one of the most progressive schools in the world, and they've done an excellent job of a slightly different model of education too.
Yeah, I've spoken with a couple of other guests about the Green School, and it's really fascinated me kind of what a different approach to education it can be. Were your children too young to attend at that age?
Our daughter went for I think 2 years, and our son was a bit too young.
Yeah, and she loved it.
She loved it. Yeah, it was great. I mean, they don't do A levels; they do a TED talk about and it's something they're passionate about. I just think that's just like so spot on.
Yeah,
it was a really, you know, it sounds utopian, but it is, and they've done it, and it's great.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries. Well, chapter 4, Sam, is the big one. Your all-time favourite destination. Where are you going to pick?
It's a really tough one. I think I need to exempt the BVI because it's a second home. So it's not a destination. It's part of my life. And then I would say it's between Bali and Byron. And I think for the reasons we've discussed previously, I would say Bali.
For Bali.
Because of the culture there. Yeah.
And did you travel much around Indonesia beyond Bali?
No, because our kids were at school. So as much as I would love to, we were on a family routine. It was different. We weren't there on holiday. We were living day in, day out, you know, weekly routines. And so we did go to Komodo Islands, which was stunning. And actually seeing the Komodos was wonderful, but actually under the sea is where it really came alive for me. And the scuba diving there is beautiful. But no, and there's other parts of Bali or the Indonesian archipelago that I would have loved to visit, and I will at some point.
Some point coming up. So obviously, like you said, recommended some great hidden gems already there, but chapter 5 is your hidden gem. What would be your ultimate choice for this chapter? A place that you love that my listeners maybe wouldn't know so much about or wouldn't have had a chance to visit?
So the Arctic is definitely on that list because it's a place that not many people have been, and sadly is you know, becoming less and less of a place as the years go by, and mainly because it's probably one of the only places I've been where I feel like I am immersed in total wilderness. You know, there is no sign of human life in so many parts of it, and there's also something really empowering and insightful around being in an environment that on the surface level can look quite bland, but when you tune into it has just got such a sense of timelessness and also because of the physical side, you know, you can't be in the Arctic without having to have gone through the motions of making sure you have the right kit and making sure you're wearing the right clothes, and you're having to push yourself out of your comfort zone, and therefore you're learning about yourself as well. So the Arctic is definitely my hidden gem.
Well, our penultimate chapter, Sam, is chapter 6, and that is your worst travel experience.
So I have a few of these. Firstly, the first thing that came to mind was it's not the place, it's being ill. And there's been times in Thailand, times in Mexico, and times in Costa Rica where I've got very ill, and you know, there's nothing worse than being in a foreign country curled over in bed very close to the toilet and feeling incredibly ill because you just feel really far away from home, and so those came to mind. When I was a kid, I can't really remember it, but my dad, it was during the Tamil Tigers, my dad got invited to Sri Lanka and by the tourism board. And I think they were trying to show, you know, tourism's coming back. And so they invited us out to this hotel. And so we flew to this hotel. And when we got there, this is secondhand information. I can't really remember, but it's a pretty bad one. My mum and dad just got the sense when we got to the hotel that just something was up. They just got this instinct. My dad usually would be like, let's just get on with it. And he and my mum both said, we need to leave. So we flew straight out and we didn't stay. And that night the Tamil Tigers came in and killed everyone in the hotel.
Oh my God.
And so that was a very near miss for us as a family.
They just sensed something.
They could just tell that it was just completely off the energy. And they were like, luckily their spidey sense pricked up and they decided to get us out. And we literally, yeah, that was a close call. And then the one that actually I think takes the biscuit, because it's the one I can remember the most, and it was, you know, my experience is I was in Chamonix doing some skiing and snowboarding with some mates when I was 18, walking home from a bar at night and just having fun, a couple of us just throwing snowballs at each other, and suddenly we hear the shouting down the street, and we're on the top of a kind of a hill road, and five guys were down there shouting at us, and they kind of looked, you know, dark clothing. And they started running towards us. And I said to my mates, oh God, you know, we're going to have to fight our way out of this. I don't know what's going on. And they ran up to us. When they got close, we realized, you know, there's nothing we could do. We all ran in different directions. One of my mates got tackled to the ground. Another friend of mine had his arms behind his back. A guy got a baton on him, and he managed to wiggle out of it and then got pinned down again. I ran through a snowy field, jumped over a fence. And when I landed, I looked up and this guy had a gun pointed at my head.
Oh my God.
And I just went into shock. I was like, I mean, it was so, the whole situation was so
terrifying
and overwhelming, and I had no idea what was going on. And then I kind of froze and I stood up, and sorry to be graphic, but the whole term shitting yourself, suddenly I realized why it's there. Luckily I didn't, but when I stood up and I realized I hadn't been shot, that's all I felt like doing.
Yeah.
And it comes from a fight or flight mechanism.
Of course.
Anyway, this guy then takes me and my mates down. They take us down an alleyway and they walk us into this building, and it's the gendarmerie. And we were like, I was in total shock. I was like, you're the police. I just could not get my head around the fact that these guys had just done that to us,
and
completely unprovoked, doing nothing wrong.
Yeah.
And then they took us in and they booked us. Luckily, my friend spoke French. He spent the next 3 hours like shouting at them in French, and they wrote this whole report. And I just remember saying, all I care about is that, you know, that it's written in the report that they used completely over necessary force. And it's, I don't really believe in suing unless it's a really specific situation. But in this occasion, you know, I've thought back on it. I wish I'd maybe taken them to court, because had that guy accidentally shot me, they would have made up a story about it. And he should not be carrying a gun if he's going to pull a gun out on an 18-year-old teenager who's done nothing wrong.
So it was the police. Yeah.
It was the police. It was the gendarmerie.
I did not expect you to say that in the end.
No, and I wasn't expecting it at the time either. And it was one of those situations. It was a total abuse of power.
Yeah.
And they were obviously just wanting to scare a bunch of British teenagers who were traveling.
Oh, my God. How awful. That's such a strange story in so many ways, because like in Chamonix, of all places as well, I just wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah? Modern first world ski resort.
Yeah.
I mean, just so ridiculous.
I was fully expecting you that to go down the avalanche route, because have you had experiences with, you know, snow and avalanches in your adventure?
Very, very luckily, I've never been caught in an avalanche. I did present a documentary years ago on testing out avalanche equipment, and I got buried in an ice chamber and, you know, testing out some equipment and what it would be like to actually be caught in an avalanche. We did have a very near miss on Mont Blanc. There's this section of Mont Blanc which It's about 200 meters across, and it's the one part of the mountain where you detach from being connected to each other, and you don't look up, you don't look down, you don't run, you literally just walk, and you get to the other side. And I was with my dad, and we detached, and there was another two people with us, and we got to the other side, and a tower of rocks fell down this couloirs. The whole mountain is a couloir, and basically the 20 people die on this one section every year. So it's the sketchiest part of the mountain. And we got to the other side, and the people behind us had just got in. And then these rock falls came. I think it's online somewhere. You can probably check it out. And I had one clip my helmet, and the guy.
Oh my God, it was that near.
Oh, it was close. Yeah, it was really, really close. And then we had to continue up the mountain afterwards, feeling pretty shaky. But that, you know, that, I had a rational head on, and so in a way that was scary. But the time in Chamonix, the whole thing was just such a blur.
Yeah,
and I was quite young, so I think that's why it was definitely takes my worst. I've basically thrown about 10 at you, but I've traveled a lot, so there's a few bad experiences there.
I appreciate you sharing them, because it's sometimes a chapter that my guests gloss over a little bit because they don't want to kind of go into any detail. Mm. I do like it when actually we can actually, because travel isn't just all, you know, the good bits. There are the bad bits too, and there are challenging situations that you can face, and, you know, it's about getting back on the horse and carrying on.
Mm, completely. I think it's best to live life going into experiences thinking it's going to be wonderful. And then as and when the challenges come up, you deal with them.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Sam, it's been really great chatting to you. I've really enjoyed it. We've been all around the world. Chapter 7, our final chapter, is a destination that's at the top of your travel bucket list.
So thank you. I've really thoroughly enjoyed the conversation too. You hold the space beautifully.
Oh, that's so sweet of you to say.
But I would say that this is an absolute easy one for me. Top of my bucket list is to do a surf trip in the Mentawai Islands.
Where are they? And
they are near Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they're a part of Indonesia. I'm not quite sure. And it's basically surf heaven. It's loads of islands, the best surf in the world, hardly anybody there. And I've got that pegged for my 40th to take my best mates and my wife and kids and try and do a trip to the Mentawai Islands. And it's just, it's like I'm surfing is my favorite sport, and to spend time with people I love in that beautiful place surfing is
out on the water.
Yeah, top of my bucket list.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. I look forward to seeing you out there. How long till your birthday?
Oh, I'm not going to be 40 for just over 2 years.
Okay, so the countdown begins.
But I've already sent a WhatsApp to my mate saying, right, you need to get fit and you need to start surfing if you don't yet, because you're the people I want to bring. I want to make sure that we can all go and enjoy it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Sam Branson. Those were your travel diaries.
Thanks so much.
What a nice conversation. Thank you so much to Sam. His debut album, Under the Static, released under his musical alter ego, Waves Rush In, is out now. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow, so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Twitter and TikTok, as of a few weeks ago, also at Holly Rubenstein. And if you can't wait until then, remember there's the first 8 seasons to catch up on. That's over 90 episodes to keep you busy there. All the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks everyone, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. It has been a long old winter here in the UK, and in between podcast seasons, I'm going to take a little bit of downtime to seek out some warmth. I'm jetting off to the Greek island of Mykonos, visiting some places that have been on my bucket list. And while I'm hopefully soaking up some Mediterranean sun, my home will be hosting guests from all over the world, thanks to Airbnb. It's the perfect way to make your travels even more rewarding. Instead of letting your home sit empty while you're off exploring new destinations, why not turn it into a cozy retreat for fellow travelers, just like I do? Whether you choose to rent out your entire space or just a spare room, it's up to you. I list my spare bedroom, and it's been a fantastic experience, both financially rewarding and a great way to connect with new people. So if you're planning your own summer getaway, or any trip for that matter, consider putting your home on Airbnb. It's a fantastic way to earn extra income that can go towards your travel expenses, souvenirs, or even that special treat you've been eyeing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb for supporting the Travel Diaries.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.